If you read between the lines of Venki's introduction, you'll know that I don't actually know anything about a faction, so I came here to learn. And indeed, I found the discussion last week quite fun. And it seemed to me that a lot of the discussion really is about the problem of the dimensionality of our perceptual space. And although the original phrasing was about how many stimuli we can distinguish, which is not exactly the same question, but of course it's related. I'd come across the problem of trying to estimate the dimensionality in which the relevant dimensionality of sensory stimuli in other contexts. And so I thought I would give a try to talking about this, and I've spent some frantic days, once I agreed to do it, I've spent some frantic days trying to reach clarity. So this is very much, let's see, somewhere between off the top of my head and work in progress. So we'll see. Let me tell you at the beginning that the problem of measuring dimensionalities is very old, and it comes up in many contexts. And actually, one of the places where it engaged a very large literature is in psychology. And it's a literature that I don't know as well as I would like, there's one formulation. So how do I measure dimensionality? So one idea is something called multidimensional scaling. And I'm not exactly sure why it has that name, but I'll define it for you. So this really comes from the psychology literature, although it probably has precursors. There's another idea, and this goes back to the 60s, I think, at least. There's another place where thinking about dimensionality arose, and that was in the 70s and 80s when people were thinking more about dynamical systems. And it was understood that dynamical systems can have, even rather complex dynamical systems, can have low dimensional attractors. And so you'd like to be able to measure the dimensionality of those attractors. Okay. And one of the crucial ideas here is something called the correlation dimension. And this really came from dynamical systems. And finally, there's an idea that my longtime collaborator Rob de Ruyter and I had about how you measure, how to analyze the responses of neurons to high-dimensional stimuli, and in particular, how to identify lower-dimensional subspaces that are relevant. And this was the idea of computing the covariance of stimuli triggered on events like spikes or more complex events. And so more generally, this is the notion of triggered correlation or triggered covariance. And I'm sure that somebody had this idea before we did, but I don't know. We never quite got straight on the history. So these are three ideas. And let me warn you that the news is not going to be so good. I think that measuring dimensionality beyond very low dimensionalities is really, really hard. And so even providing convincing evidence that something's not low dimensional can be hard. So let me try to now think about this in the context of perception. So let me it's not completely obvious what we mean by the dimensionality of a perceptual space. So we need some definitions. Of course, there's one case that we understand completely, as was discussed, and that's color vision. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we understand it completely and it's three-dimensional. Okay. So three has a certain obvious advantage, but also three isn't a very big number. And for many purposes, it's two, right? Take out absolute luminance and you're down to two dimensions. And as you'll see, everything is easier the lower the number of dimensions. And in particular, if it's only two or three dimensions, and you have enough people and enough decades, and it was back during a period where we weren't quite so distracted, namely the 1800s, you know, you could just do it exhaustively, right? I mean, more or less, we don't understand that vision is, that color vision is three-dimensional because of some immensely clever algorithm, right? It was sort of exhaustive, right? People just kept trying things, and gradually you realize that every color that you can make can be placed into a three-dimensional space, and furthermore, that in that space, color mixing, which of course was something that was known about long before people tried doing real experiments, color mixing was vector addition. And so, yes?
So, this is a historical question. So how did it go? Did people thought that it was many dimensions and then they converged to low, or they start with one and then two and then three,
So I don't know the history as well as I should, but remember that the artists came first. So they knew there were primary colors, right? Right, sorry?
Started with three and then six.
Yes, well, yeah, okay. So, you know, there's mixing and there's subtraction, right? There's addition and subtraction. And there's okay, there's mixing the lights and mixing the paints. Look, you give a child a collection of colored paints, and they quickly figure out that if you keep mixing things, you get blah, right? So it's not the case that if you keep mixing, you get infinitely more things, right?
May I ask you a slightly different?
I haven't actually.
Historical question.
Okay.
So when the first notion appears in scientific literature about dimensionality, who asked this question? When were the question asked in which context? Because
there's a book called De Colore, which is written in the 1100s.
1100s.
Yeah, and I'm blanking on the name. There's very interesting work by Tom McLeish, who some of you will know, who's a soft condensed matter physicist. Giles, and I'm blanking on his last name, and Hannah Smithson, who's a visual psychophysicist, who at one point were all at Durham. So physicist, psychologist, and a medieval historian. And so they went back to this book. And turns out, why do I know this? I don't know. I know Tom, and he was really excited when he did this. So he came and told me about it. So they gave this beautiful analysis of what was in there. And many people thought that he had a much simpler view. But if you look carefully, you realize that it's startlingly close to our modern view. And in fact, it would be even closer if a couple of the words in the manuscript were rendered slightly differently in Latin. And so you may know that most medieval manuscripts that you try to lay your hands on, you have copies. So you have to find the family tree of the copies. And then you discover that if you go back on the family tree to something more original, it is rendered the way it needed to be in order for the thing to make more sense. It's a very old idea, okay? And so I don't, you know, really it would require a historian, a real historian, not a scientist who dabbles in history, right?
But as a physicist, I'm surprised you're not quoting Newton on that term, no? Are they the first pioneer
Sure, right. I mean, the...
no way, maybe it's...
Well, I actually think...
The continuum.
Look,
the continuum and not...
Right. So in some way, telling you that white light can be separated into many distinguishable colors it's true, and it's very dramatic, and that tells you what the relationship is. But in some sense, it's on the road to understanding the relationship. So color vision is hard because there's two different notions of mixing, right? There's mixing the lights and mixing the pigments, which thankfully you don't have that one in olfaction, right? You have other problems, but you don't have that one. You only have the analog of mixing the lights, I think. So we should be careful. At least in the way people usually talk about it, that would be the analog. And of course, and I actually don't remember what else happened. That was one of the reasons I jumped back to the Middle Ages. It's really a very old idea. That there should be some notion like this is very old. When it got settled on three, and what you mean by settled. Okay, that's a project. Maybe there is. If somebody knows a good history book on this, it would be nice. But I don't. Peter.
So I missed last week. But presumably perceptual space and outer space are slightly different.
Precisely.
That's the whole point of this talk.
So it's worth emphasizing, let's take the case of vision, of color vision again. It is not the case that colors are three-dimensional, right? That the light, that the physical stimulus is three-dimensional. You can make light with an arbitrary dependence of the irradiance on wavelength. And so you can get as high dimensionality as you want. And many of you probably know that there are organisms that have more types of receptors than we do, notably the mantid shrimps that have 10. It is at least a plausible argument that the reason we have three is because most of the colors that we encounter arise from scattering off of surfaces whose appearance is dominated by the absorption properties of large organic pigment molecules, and those absorption spectra are broad, and therefore you can't put little wiggles into the spectrum by scattering off of them. On the other hand, if you live underwater and you encounter tropical fish, which we think of as being very colorful, we're actually missing a noticeable fraction of the story, because those colors arise largely not from pigments, but from interference. And with interference, you can produce very sharp structures in the spectrum. And so there are organisms that make their living hunting tropical fish, like mantid shrimps, which are terrifying creatures, if you've ever watched them. Anyhow, I recommend, there are a few good videos about this. If you make your living hunting tropical fish, it's actually useful to distinguish, to have a basis for describing color which is richer than three. And they do.
Also, in fact, I don't know if it's magic or not, they actually essentially use some version of the label line for the color, right?
So then the question is, what do they do with this? And actually, it's an interesting question. So there, too, there's a controversy about the dimensionality of perception. So, one question is, in what dimension are we doing the comparisons? And then the other one is, can we actually fill that space, or are we stuck on the axes? And so there is a paper claiming that the shrimps are stuck on the axes.
Yeah. Bill, so for color, it's basically you get 3D, you get the three cones, right? I mean, you could get smaller, but it gets bigger.
Exactly.
For ORNs, you get ORNs, it's at levels receptor neurons, it's high dimensional. So you're talking about there, you're talking about psychologically after we
Let me now actually try and define the problem, okay? Yeah.
One question. So color space, you can parameterize by one dice parameter, right? The wavelength, basically, and then maybe the amplitudes for each wavelength. So in olfaction, you cannot do it. So is this also a reason?
Well, that's certainly an enormous.
So much easier?
Well, so.
Because you have like an intrinsic metric there already or whatever.
Right. So in some sense, not only. Not only is it the case that the dimensionality of our perceptions turns out to be low, so there's several things happening, right? One is the dimensionality turns out to be low. The collapse from the high dimensional space of possible physical stimuli to the low dimensional space of our percepts happens at the level of the receptors. So that's good because that means you can never train anybody out of it, right? You could imagine, for instance, that if the collapse to a low-dimensional space happens deeper inside your brain, then, and I'll try and be a little more specific in just a moment, then while somehow generically you do something low-dimensional, if I work really hard, I might be able to distinguish some of those dimensions that I normally collapse. And then any hope of actually measuring this would be shot, right? It's also true that the collapse of dimensionality by the receptors, I guess the way of saying it, the way of talking about wavelength is it's local in the natural physical dimensions, right? So there's an obvious notion in principle, right? And indeed with interference filters, this is kind of true. The light intensity at wavelength number one and wavelength number two don't really need to be related to each other. And in fact, right, with an interference filter, it's this wavelength and a wavelength over here, which are actually naturally related to each other. Given that we actually use pigments, then it turns out that in some sense, the different physical dimensions can themselves be put in an order. And it's actually important to distinguish the notion of a metric, right? The metric on the perceptual space of color is a metric which acts on coordinates, intensity of cone number one, intensity of cone number two, intensity of cone number three. It is not a metric on wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the fact that there is a natural ordering of the wavelengths helps a lot in figuring things out. But okay, good. So what I'm going to suggest is that perceptual distance should be related to the probability of a correct same different distinction. Okay? And then indeed that's what you mean by perception. I can say that's what you mean by perceptual distance. You can think about other things. For example, you could think about asking people to rate similarity. When you ask people to rate similarity, you're not guaranteed that you get anything that's remotely metric. In fact, if I ask you how similar is A to B, the answer does not have to be the same as if I asked you how similar is B to A. On the other hand, if I ask you, here are A and B, are they the same or different? That's symmetric, right? If I present them to you at the same time or yes.
So when we say same and different, somebody has to define what is same.
I ask you, right? So I'm going to give you two stimuli.
No, I understand that, but
so A and A are by definition distance zero,
right.
And then and they presumably, if I force you to say same or different, you'll
right.
I don't know what you'll do, right? So if on the other hand, if I give you two things, and I ask you to do same or different. Or ask you, are these different? Then as I pull them apart in distance, then your probability of correctly answering, presumably if they're very close together, then you'll choose 50-50, right? You can't tell.
So, the probability of correct same and different is defined by the...
So I give you two, so the experimenter gives you two different physical stimuli.
Okay.
And those have coordinates in some physical space. And I now ask you, same or different, and I know that you're not going to give a completely deterministic answer. So what I want to know is the probability that you will correctly do it. Okay?
So I guess the problem is correct, right?
Well, if they're physically different.
But everything's a little bit physically different. Why can't it just be the probability of saying that they're different instead of saying correct? I'm not sure what correct is doing that. It's my question.
Which
You're just saying probability of same different.
Yeah, probability of same different.
I guess if they're physically, so I guess if they're physically different, and you call them the same, you're wrong. And so that was why. I'm sorry. There are fields in which one can control stimuli. Olfactory happens. Olfaction happens not to be one of them. But you know, it is actually possible to control the stimuli. And it could be that the origins of the noise which prevent you from making the discrimination are, you know, very early in the process, but nonetheless, there's a notion of the stimuli being the same or not, physically. Yes?
So you have to, this assumes you know how to make something different in some measured way.
Okay, let me, I haven't gotten very far, obviously. So, the next thing that I'm going to say is that the square of perceptual distance should be quadratic in the physical difference. For small delta s. So I'm going to insist that whatever, wherever it is that you make your perceptual comparisons, you've not done something so terrible that you've lost analyticity in the, so that you have not done something so terrible that if I try to formalize the notion of distance in the space where you actually make the comparisons, I've lost analyticity in the original physical coordinates of the stimulus. I'm not saying anything global, right? And that's important. I'm not insisting that there is a well-defined mapping that I can specify from all physical stimuli to some perceptual space. Say locally, right? I'm going to focus on your ability to make distinctions. And you know that when you want to measure somebody's ability to make a distinction, you don't do it by taking things that are very far apart. You do it by taking things that they can usually get right most of, you know, three quarters of the time, right? You try to probe the region where they're just barely able to tell them apart. And I'm going to say that in that region, I think I should have this analytic idea, OK? And so now, so in particular, since this is the physical difference, let me define the dimensionality of the stimulus space. Sorry. Let's call it d sub s. And this could be very large. So, for example, if we were thinking about color, this would be, and we actually had access to monochromatic lights as a way of building up colors, which, by the way, is very late in the history of our understanding of color, but never mind, then this is the number of different wavelengths that I'm mixing together, right? And the coordinates are the intensities at the different wavelengths. But now it's clear, so now it's clear what you mean. The dimensionality of the perceptual space is the rank of the metric tensor. So if what happens is that you take these very high dimensional physical stimuli and you map them into some low-dimensional space, for example, as happens with the absorption of light by the three different cones, then even if you do discrimination experiments by jiggling the intensities of 100 different wavelengths, of course, what happens is that the 100-dimensional vector that describes the wavelength that describes the intensities at every wavelength is projected down into three dimensions. And that's where the comparison occurs. And so the rank of this matrix cannot be 100, right? It'll be only 3. So that's what I'm going to say I mean by the dimensionality of the perceptual space. Okay? So there is a couple of things. I think the most important thing to emphasize is that this is a local definition. I'm not a properly trained mathematician, so I'm not going to expound on the distinction between local and global definitions of dimensionality, but let me emphasize that there's an obvious difference, right? If I tell you there's, for some purposes, this is two-dimensional, and then, for other purposes, it's three-dimensional. So be careful, right? That's the lesson. And locally, I think, we all know what we're talking about. Now, can you make measurements with differences, can you make reliable measurements with differences that are small enough that talking locally makes sense? I don't know. Okay, that you have to worry about, right? So this is, we're not asking, give me a very large number of different things that are all very different from each other. What's the space in which we embed them? Let me also make another point, which is that normally when we think about dimensionality, we usually are given the points. And then we ask, what is the dimensionality of the space in which the points lie? So Alex, you tried an approach very much like that, which is described using people's verbal descriptions to give us coordinates for every odor. So in this view, I'm going to assume that we can't do that. Sorry. I'm really interested in this. I want to learn more about it. But the approach that I decided to think about was one in which you only make comparisons. And so an early version, that is indeed the version that psychologists thought about for a long time. And they had this idea of multidimensional scaling. So how does that work? So let's talk about idea number one. So how does idea number one work? So you're given the set of distances between pairs of stimuli, ij, and let's say I runs from 1 up to some number of stimuli. So you're given ns minus 1 over 2 distances. What you then say is, well, I don't know what space these things came out of. In fact, so let's be concrete. If we were thinking about olfaction, the way you would do it is you would have your favorite set of molecules, and you would adjust the concentrations of each of those molecules. Okay? And you might try to pick them based on what you know about the olfactory receptors, or you might not. But that would be the physical coordinate space that you started in, and that could be very high dimensional. And then you would choose some set of them that are reasonably close to each other so that you can ask people, can you tell these apart or not? And across the set, you'll get some interesting set of answers. You won't get always yes, because they're all very far out in some uninteresting directions. And so then the idea of multidimensional scaling is to say, let's represent each stimulus by some vector yi, and then let's compute the distances . Let's compare those distances to the experimentally given distances. Then let's sum up over all the pairs. We'll call that chi squared. And we minimize. You always know, right? If you call it chi squared, you should minimize it. And you minimize it based on your choices. But of course, nobody told you in what dimensionality you should try to embed things. And so what you will find is that even the minimum value of chi squared depends on the dimensionality of the vectors y. And if the distances are actually realizable, right? So they really are distances among points that live in some space, then, you know, this will actually go to zero somewhere. If they're not realizable, then, you know, something bad happens. And, you know, maybe you get lucky and most of the variance lives in some low dimensional thing, but I don't know. So, you know, this can have some complicated dependence. Yes?
So, Gil, I'm puzzling over something here. So suppose the vectors yi were in some dimension n, but were sparse, k-sparse in the sense of having many zeros. You know that they are also embeddable in that same set of vectors is also embeddable in a bit more than k dimensions while preserving all the distances. So, but whereas the somehow true dimension of this original vector might have been very high.
So, this gets to, so there's two issues here, right? One is, if the representations that we build internally have this sparse property, then what did you mean by the dimensionality?
Right.
Okay. And it might be that although this sounds good, it's not actually enough to answer that question. So I can, if I don't have access to the representation that you built, I could recode them into a space of lower dimensionality. And so probably this definition would recover the lower dimensional one, not the higher.
Okay, I see. So the place where it intersects the lowest dimension where faithful.
Okay, so now the problem is the following. So I'm not an expert on multidimensional scaling. In fact, although I knew it existed, I only started, okay, you will not be surprised to learn that the first thing I thought of was number two. I actually brought that up on, or was Wednesday. And then I realized number three, which is interesting because this one I actually knew about and had something to do with, but somehow that wasn't the first one that occurred to me, which is interesting. It has to do presumably with the dimensionality of the space in which ideas are stored. And then I realized, oh, but wait, you know, there's this thing that everybody's been doing. So why isn't that the answer? So I'm going to tell you what I know, which is very little. There is a convenient thing, which is that you don't actually have to write a program to do this, because this is so standard that, you know, it's one line in MATLAB now, right? So you can go home and play, and this is not a substitute for analysis. I don't actually know where to find the analysis of the impact of measurement errors on multidimensional scaling. There is one somewhere, presumably, okay? Because I actually think it's a disaster. Okay. What do you do? One is you could trace out this curve, but actually easier is to allow dy to be large so that you know you're down here somewhere, and maybe even out here, and then do a singular value decomposition of the y's that you get back, right? So if I try to embed them in a space that's too big, and it turns out that they could have been embedded in something smaller, still Euclidean, right? So the assumption is that so you have to agree in advance on what norm you want to use in the, how you measure distance in the space of y's. Let's assume it's Euclidean. If it's Euclidean and it turns out that they could have been done in a lower dimensional space, then you'll discover that if you do a singular value decomposition, you get a low dimensionality. Okay. So the easiest way to do this is give yourself a high dimension, solve the problem, and then do a singular value decomposition. Okay. Yes?
So this Y is actually what you are the representation in this Y with a hat with an arrow.
Yeah.
That is what you actually what your fitting procedure will find,
yes.
Right? But can you like cheat a little bit, like because we know other things, not only this, we don't only know this perceptual measurement, but we can like cheat, like looking at the Bernoulli map of.
You could try. Yeah, so there are, I mean, look, like this is,
activation, like
there's decades of literature on this.
Yeah.
So it's certainly the case that, you know, there's the most general mathematical formulation of the problem, which is something like what I just gave you. You could be a little more abstract or more precise. And then, you know, there's variations that were introduced over the decades, which, you know, I don't know as much about this as I should. Yes?
But why do you think very sensitive to noise?
Experiment. Yeah. So let me now ask, suppose I actually tried to do this. Okay. The problem is that you don't actually get to start with perfect measurements of these. If the way you're going to do it is by measuring the probability of making a correct discrimination, then you know, let me put this off in the corner. So think back to sort of basic signal detection theory, right? So if I have some internal representation of a signal, I know that it's not completely deterministic. So I have one signal whose So this is the probability of y given signal number one. And then let's say I have here the probability of y given signal number two. And you know that the probability of making an error is that. And the natural way of measuring distance here is to say that this width is one. And then this is the distance, and then that generalizes the higher dimensions. And if I then look at the probability of correct discrimination as a function of distance, it starts at 0.5, it ends at 1, and it does this. And how do you do this? You ask people to do it again and again and again. And of course, you're going to get an error bar here. Which is roughly 1/√ of the number of trials that you used in estimating the probability. If you use 100 trials, then the square root of n is 10, and 1/√ is 0.1. But this is only 0.5. And it's plus or minus, right? So you'll notice that your error bar on the, actually, sorry, let me be more careful. This is zero. Your error bar on the distance axis is a noticeable fraction of the distance itself. Yes. So let me just say, for many purposes, this is not a problem. Okay. If I ask you how discriminable are these two stimuli, and you give me the threshold for reliable discrimination, and you only know it to 40%, that's fine for many purposes. The problem is that if you try to measure n squared of these distances, and you all know each of them to 40% accuracy, the thing you write down is not a distance matrix. Right? Doesn't obey the, there's, you know, you can go and compute what's the probability you violate the triangle inequality. Yes?
But as long as n is large compared to n, the number of points, it should be important for n.
So, So what I did was I started playing with NT and NS. If you just use the standard packages, you discover that until NT gets to be about 500, for any reasonable NS, the thing just chokes and says, sorry, that's not a distance matrix. Okay. Now you have to ask how much accuracy do I need in order to have a reasonably consistent distance matrix? Yes?
So to run MDS, does anybody really, DIJ can be not a distance matrix, you still run it, right? Does it give nonsensical results? You can imagine, get lucky. Machine learning, after all. Maybe
not. I'm going to tell you what I know, and then I'll tell you what I would like to know. So I would like to have a real analysis of all of this. And for all I know, it's been done somewhere, and I just haven't found it. And then the other possibility is that, we have to actually do some work. So experimentally, if you simulate this situation, pick NS stimuli that live in a space of some actual dimensionality, the dimensionality in which you're actually making your perceptual comparison, compute the distances between them, take this curve, generate n trials of which the probability of being, n sub t trials of which the probability of being correct is this thing, then take the value of PC that you get by averaging over those nt trials, invert this curve to give yourself a distance, and then plug it into multidimensional scale. Okay. Unless NT is large, it doesn't work. And what I found is that if you want to, so two things to note. So you might think, if I want to know whether things live in 10 dimensions, surely I don't need that many. I mean, if I could give you the vectors, that by the time you had 20 or 30 of them, you'd be sure that they lived in 10 dimensions and not more, even if you were a little noisy, right? And we understand how that works. This seems to be disastrous. And also, notice the scaling, right? It goes as the square of the number of stimuli. And then you have to multiply by how many times you presented each pair. So if you have to present each pair 500 times, and you want to do, surely you can't infer 10 dimensions from fewer than 10 vectors. So now we're at 100 times 500, well, divided by 2. We're easily in the hundreds of thousands of stimuli, of trials. And in fact, what I found was that the standard packages would not return. What you want is that when you do a singular value decomposition of the y's, you see 10 dimensions up here and then some garbage down here. And that structure does not appear clearly until you have many millions of trials. Okay. So maybe I'm missing something. And perfectly possible. This is a very well-mined technique. And so probably there's lots of clever things you can do. But I don't see it. Okay, it looks really hard. It would seem that to get a structure in which if I look at the singular value decomposition of y, and what I see is, the true dy and then some garbage, this is a function of how many trials and how many comparisons. Then, if you give too few, then you're just going to see something that looks like that. And this seems to be bigger than a million, this transition, okay? So it's hard, as far as I can see. Again, I would like to have a better understanding rather than just playing around, but I thought I should play around with the thing which seems to be the standard before telling you that I have something that might be a little bit better. But I'm even not that optimistic about that. So correlation dimension. I hope it's clear. my first pass through this is pessimistic, but it's also anecdotal. So it would be nice to have a real analysis.
Okay, now here, how pessimistic? So a million was an estimate for approximately 10, if you want to make sure that something's at least 10 dimensional. A million trials is annoying for humans, but I think for mice.
So this is 10, this is, I mean, I thought about actually showing these, but again, they're anecdotes, right? So this is 10 dimensions. You choose the stimuli so that on average they have distance one from each other so that you have 75% correct, right? You do all the things and then, yeah, you need a few million trials before the gap opens up. Okay, yes?
To the next idea. So we've been discussing last week near the board. A different approach to the same problem, I understand. Not correlation dimension, not the covariance matrix, but how the dimensions kind of grow up. You know, you were talking about the different ideas of the same stuff, not making all pairwise.
So this is actually the correlation dimension idea. So the, hang on. So the, let me.
Dynamics.
Yeah, the I.
Sorry,
it's an adaptation of the correlation dimension idea. So the thing that we were talking about is what I'm going to talk about now. So the way in which so correlation dimension in the so the original idea was, I show you a bunch of points which are the coordinates of some dynamical system. I would like to know the dimensionality of the attractor on which they live. So they presumably live on some manifold which is not the dimensionality that you measure, right? The raw physical dimensionality is lower. And so the idea was, so there are several ideas that go into this, but let me focus on the part that's essential for what we were talking about. So one idea is to do something that is in this same spirit. So you take not the coordinates, but the distances between pairs of points. And you ask, what is the probability that two points are a distance d apart? And so what this is making use of, in fact, to be more precise, what is the probability that two points are less than d apart? And what this is making use of is the fact that if I sit at one point and I look outward and I ask how many other points am I going to find, the answer is the distance that I'm willing to look raised to the power of the dimensionality with some coefficient out in the front. Okay? And so that's the thing that you're trying to use in the case of dynamical systems. The idea was, well, I have some time series. Let me try to make all the pairwise comparisons within that time series so I have more points. But it's, I can also think about just asking, if I had some reference point and then I take another, I start choosing points at random, what is the probability that the distance to point I is less than d? That will be proportional to d raised to the power of the dimensionality of the space. Okay. So this suggests a design in which instead of comparing lots of points with each other in all the pairs, you take one reference stimulus and you present it with another nearby stimulus and you ask, are they the same or different? So you always measure to the same point. And you now essentially ask, as I fill up the space by picking lots of things, what's the probability, I know how to, what's the probability that, let's be careful. Okay. So now
the detection looks pretty bad.
Yeah, you can see that already. Yes.
Suppose you have a skeleton made of linear elements that covers several dimensional space. Right. So then, if you're d,
so
if your d lint small is less than the size of the skeleton, you'll have an answer t dimension equals to one.
Exactly. So well, so that's it's worse than that. So. Well, that's one corner in which it fails. There's others. So what are we actually going to do? So we have a reference stimulus sitting here, which is this one. And then here we have, so let's call it S0. And then here we have the stimuli SI. And what we're going to do is we're going to measure the probability of correctly discriminating SI from S0. And then that's going to give us a distance I by basically using this curve backwards. And then we're going to put all the, now you basically sort you put the distances in order from the smallest to the largest, and you put their rank, and you make a log-log plot, and then this slope should be the dimensionality. That's the idea that I just told you.
This feels like the fractals in
the dimension. Yes, I mean, that's where this all came from. So now, there's a very nice, so some of you are aware that there are many corners of the scientific literature in which people look for power law relationships, some more convincing than others. And there's a very nice quip by the mathematical physicist David Gruelle, which came not long after this idea was introduced, in which he observed the following. In order to be convincing that you saw something that scales as a parallel, so first of all, you should realize, down here, you can't see it, because in high-dimensional spaces, there aren't very many things that are close together. Right? On a line, it's okay. By the time you're in the plane already, right? In order to be close, you have to have two coordinates be close, so on. So you can't see it down here because of bad sampling. And you can't see it out here because of lots of reasons. So there's something, your distance measure isn't quite linear, things saturate because you only use so many trials and everything. So you need to see a convincing intermediate range over which this scaling is observed. And so his observation was that if you want to see one decade on the x-axis, then this is 10 to the d. And so if you want to see dimensionality D, you're going to need to make 10 to the D comparisons. Okay? Which, by the way, don't feel bad. There are lots of very reputable scientists who published papers which declared that they had found power laws in various things, and they missed this. Okay. So I could go through the details. Yes.
I would actually argue that the auto-weighted provision D is already a problem.
Yeah, so very good, right? So this is if somebody actually gave you the Ds.
Yes,
this problem exists even before we discuss whether D can be measured accurately. So this is without error bars.
Right.
This is just, would you believe anybody who showed you any less than this? And Ruel's answer was no. And so that means that if somebody does this, and you know they can't get an answer which is bigger than log 10 of the number of comparisons that they made. And unless they get something which is significantly smaller, they haven't done anything. Okay. So it's worse than that, of course, because as you point out, well, there's several ways of saying it. One is I don't really have access to a very large range here because this curve is compressive. Another way of saying it is that even if you try to stay in the sweet spot, you have error bars. Actually, if you're willing to do 500 trials for every comparison, then the difference between the raw problem and the sampled version of the problem is not so bad. I was surprised by that. I thought that.
I would love to see
this. Okay, but this is still pessimistic, because it means that you're going to need to make. So, again, it depends on the dimensionality, right? So if the thing is really low dimensional, 5, then it's not so bad. If it's 10-dimensional. Yeah, but would you believe? But now, if you only see half an order of magnitude, you have to really believe that your errors in measuring the distances didn't.
Yeah, no. But if you measure one order of magnitude, I believe you less, because it definitely not. I would believe that two distances that actually in our space, the distances in one order of magnitude apart is actually meaningful.
Distance 2 and 0.2. Those don't seem so bad.
Yeah, but 2 is big number.
2 corresponds to getting it right 90% of the time, 95% of the time, and 0.2 corresponds to getting it right 55%. So somewhere there's a limit.
No, that's exactly the problem, that, you know, you're good at this, you know.
Yes, right. Okay. I mean, so the idealized version of the problem is already bad.
Yeah.
And as we back away from the ideal, it's clearly not going to get better. Yes.
So I need these many measurements to establish a power law. But what if I say I know that there is a power law because of this, you know, the theory tells me that.
Yes.
So given that I know that there is a power law, I will measure it, I will have an exponent, and maybe it will have an error bar. And I will just say, well, this is an error bar.
So that's a very interesting question. I think that what that requires is that you have a model for what's going on down here and up here, right? So if you took this completely literally, which there's a variety of reasons you might not want to, then this doesn't just predict that in this region you'll see power law. It actually predicts the whole thing, right? So you could say, if I have a very strong model, I might be able to convince myself that this, I mean, D is then just one parameter in the model. And so, and in fact, I guess if I really take this picture seriously, then there are, you don't, so, in this region, you're not sensitive to the distribution of distances that you sampled, right? Out here you are, right? So if in fact the way you did this was to generate, if the vectors that are being compared are Gaussian random vectors in capital D dimensions, then you also need to know the average distance, but that you can get, right? But then the way in which things roll over here is sensitive to the assumption that things are Gaussian. So if in fact they're not quite Gaussian, then you really can't. So if you knew it was Gaussian, then if they're Gaussian and it's isotropic, right, then there's only two parameters. There's the dimensionality and the average distance. And so you could say, what's the problem, right? I get a lot of data and I fit two parameters. And the fact that I don't need to know that I see the power law. All I need to show is that if D is 10 and D is 8, I can tell them apart. That's not a bad idea. I think that your assumptions about, my guess is that if I made slightly different assumptions about the nature of the distribution, for example, if in the space where the comparisons are happening, the coefficients were exponentially rather than Gaussian distributed, my guess is that you would then discover that you'd done something wrong. And I don't know whether whether the data would be powerful enough to tell you that that was true. So yeah, I mean, and I guess this is kind of Peter's question, right? There's this whole field out there which people learn these very big models, and you know, why are you being so conservative? And you know, so part of the answer is, do you want direct evidence for this claim, or do you want to embed that claim in a much larger model? And within the class of models, you do your best, and out pops an estimate for your claimed parameter. And again, in machine learning, usually the values of the parameters have no significance except their ability to predict more data points. Whereas in this case, you're actually trying to make a claim about nature, and so you would be a little more suspicious.
Okay. Just while reflecting, while listening to you, I'm getting more and more confused about what we even want to mean by this kind of thing. Let me explain three of the confusion, maybe people in the audience can answer it.
Yes.
One issue is that many of these things assume that the space in which these things are embedded is somehow flat and Euclidean, which is far from obvious. And you can have all kinds of distance things.
Locally.
Yeah, but you know, you're interested in the end and also looking at the distance.
But you'll notice that this discussion is only about local things.
Okay, then let me pursue another one at the same time. Right, things can happen.
Precisely for that reason, by the way. Yeah.
You take two things, make them further and further apart, they eventually look closer together because the whole space actually closed or certainly topologically more complicated. So that seems to be potentially important.
But again, that's why I said that I think it's I think it's important that to state the hypothesis that we have some analyticity in the physical variables. So although I believe that can happen, I would be very surprised if it happened I would be very surprised if you couldn't find a regime in which if I start with two things that are almost identical and I pull them apart so that you're distinguishing them correctly 75% of the time, I would be very surprised if somehow you had wrapped around already.
But to solve this issue of there's a lot of noise in the measurement, the basic way you need to get around it is by looking at things that are very far apart. So the noise in their measurement is
so
smaller than their separation.
Okay, so now let me make another point, which is that as long as what you're using is the probability of making a correct discrimination, then in these techniques that doesn't help you. Because the probability of making a correct discrimination is a very insensitive function of distance out here. So you don't win by pulling things apart.
Okay.
You still have a problem.
One more confusion, which I'm going to find difficult to even express. So let me give it a go. So let me suppose I have three things, A, B, and C, that I'm trying to perceive. Mm-hmm. And let's suppose the process by which I look at the difference or perceive the difference between B and C goes along this surface. Mm-hmm. But the process along which I tend to process A and B goes along the higher dimensional manifold. So in effect, it could be that really the perception, we're trying to think about it, is all glued together. And the distances are always measured. Mm-hmm. But the perceptual distance are always being measured in terms of the same geometry. But it could be that they're just different processes that you use.
Absolutely. So in some sense, right,
just to make sure I understand the question, are you saying that there's just not even one space?
For example, imagine subspaces like this, right? Imagine here's this one-dimensional line, and you know A and B are on that line, and you kind of know that, and sort of C is off it.
That's okay, right? That just means that the real space is high dimensional and some of the stimuli happen to be along some axes.
But the perceptual process that you use uses the distance along this line for A and B, but uses the full high dimensional distance for A and C. It could be the case, because you know already that somehow A and B are connected in some interesting way. This is going back to your lack of Schwartz of triangle inequalities that triggered this.
So
that's one way in which you could get that.
Right. So why not? I mean, look.
Okay.
I'm So I'm not completely sure whether what you're describing is excluded by my insistence on looking at things which are near each other in the original physical space and insisting that there's some differentiability as I pass through to the mapping into perceptual space. Now, of course, that hypothesis could be wrong, right? You could just say, no, when you compare these things, you do one thing, and when you compare these things, you do something else. And so there is no, but you have to know that these are in one category. And
you may make a low-dimensional model inside the head of some familiar experiences, but leave
yes.
open the possibility of higher-dimensional
yes.
experience of the unfamiliar world.
That, right,
that's,
and you're saying that even nearby in physical coordinates, I could have things that were sufficiently unfamiliar.
Yeah. In fact, it probably happens, I think.
Yes. Good. So, I gave the title as a question, and so the first question, of course, is, can you make the question precise? and I don't know the answer, right? So what I was doing was trying to say, well, I can try, and when you try, that then suggests different ways of trying to answer the question experimentally, and that already has problems. So let me tell you let me emphasize something in common with the two things that we've talked about here, and then I'll give you the third one, and then we can stop. So what's in common here is that it's a procedure that uses a notion of distance that you measure. There's something you measure that you're going to try and identify with a distance. And that's true at a very high level, right? There's the detail of exactly how you map that onto doing a psychophysical experiment, but there's also conceptually, you know, the idea of multidimensional scaling is, can you tell me something about the dimensionality of space that you live in by telling me all the pairwise distances among some large collection of points? The idea of correlation dimension is, well, volumes grow as distance raised to the power of the dimensionality, so show me the distribution of distances and I'll tell you the dimensionality. The problem is that to measure a distance between physical stimuli, you have to present the pair many times, unless the subjects give you extraordinarily reliable answers about what their measure of distance is. So if you're thinking that the way you're going to get distance is by asking, how easy is it to tell them apart, or for that matter, give me a rating, if these things are noisy, well, if I ask you how hard is it to tell them apart, you know that that's probabilistic. And so you know exactly how hard it is to get an accurate measurement. It's the square root of n problem, right, with the p1 minus p out in front. But then if you say, well, if you ask people for a distance, then it's a question of how reliable are they in giving you a rating, and I don't know anything about that, so that's an interesting question. Maybe you could do better. But another possibility is that you could do something which doesn't require you to revisit the same stimuli or the same pair of stimuli many, many times, that you get to just wander around. I mean, and remember, the notion that so maybe you can just wander around and learn something about the dimensionality of the space in which comparisons are being made. And so the comparison here is to what we do when we analyze the response of neurons to complex signals. One way to do it is to repeat the same stimulus over and over again, but you know that if you're actually trying to map the relationship between the inputs and the outputs, that's actually very inefficient. What you want to do is to wander around in the space of stimuli and use correlations between the input and the output to tell you something about the nature of the transformation. So suppose that what people report is a binary yes or no that the stimuli are the same or different. And the average of this thing is the probability that we've been talking about, which is a function of distance. So now suppose that I'm in this situation where I have a reference stimulus, and then I have many, many other stimuli. And so let me agree that the coordinates of this stimulus are actually zero, and so this stimulus is a vector S, okay? By which I actually mean the difference, not the... So what I can do is to ask, suppose I compute this object. So I take the vector S, and I multiply by 1 every time somebody said, yeah, I think that's different from 0, and I multiply by 0 when I don't. And if you want to, you can normalize by the average number of times the guy said yes. And so this is the analog for perception of computing something like the spike-triggered average stimulus, which also goes under the name of reverse correlation. And there is a literature on using reverse correlation in perception to try and understand, right, this gives you a vector. And so since it gives you a vector, if I'm asking you to make a discrimination, then this is the, if the vector's S, if the stimuli were chosen from the correct distribution to begin with, and I'll say something about that in a moment, then this is a vector that points along the axis that people are actually using to make the discrimination. Okay. Now, presumably, if I ask you to make a same different discrimination, and the way I get the stimuli is I choose, let's say, I have some number of physical coordinates, and I choose a Gaussian random number along each coordinate relative to the central reference stimulus, presumably this will average to zero. Okay, I mean, again, if these distances are not too big, I mean, so the next object that you can compute is you take the alpha component of stimulus S and the beta component of stimulus S. And this gives you a ds by ds matrix, right? This is, since the average stimulus is zero, this is the covariance matrix of stimuli triggered on the person saying yes. And the important point is that just as we do with spikes, you know, you don't have to revisit everything many times, you just compute the correlations, okay? So now, let me do a tiny bit of algebra, which some of you know. And it's known under different names in different fields. So the crucial algebraic step is the following. Suppose that the probability distribution of the vectors S is Gaussian. So the mean will be 0. And there'll be some covariance matrix C alpha beta. Then, this is true. Okay. No matter what the function f is, as long as I can differentiate it, then if I multiply by the alpha component, then what I get back is the covariance matrix multiplied by the derivative, or the gradient of the function. So let me I can carry this through with all the, well, why not? So now you can do this twice, and what you'll get that. So you do it twice and you get this, but you'll notice that this thing is just that. So 2, 3, 4. So okay. For half a dozen of you, that helped. this is Wick's theorem, right? In disguise, right? So presumably, for the set of people who understand what I'm talking about, I don't need to explain anymore. Is that right? We okay? Good. It's a general thing about Gaussian random variables, which has particular resonance for theoretical physicists of a certain age, or who remember that particular part of their field theory course. What's important here is that, so what does this mean? What I want to compute is the covariance matrix of the stimulus triggered on the times when the guy said yes. But you can think of computing this average in two steps. First, imagine that you delivered the stimuli many, many times, because after all, you're computing an average. So hopefully, if I average over all the things I did, it's effectively the same, right? So if you want to average, you should average first over the stochastic behavior of the observer. When you average over the stochastic behavior of the observer, that doesn't change the stimuli. That turns the indicator 1, 0 into the probability that he says 1. And now you have sitting here some function. And now you're back doing the calculation over there. But if the function is a function of distance measured somehow in this space, then since these stimuli are all small, it's a function of this quadratic form. What that means is that when you start taking derivatives, you're going to get factors related to this matrix G. And it doesn't take too much more algebra to show that if this matrix is of low rank, then this matrix is also of low rank. So what that means is that if I compute the difference between the triggered covariance and the raw, or the stimulus covariance, I will isolate a term whose rank is the dimensionality, or whose rank is the rank of G, which is the thing we've decided to call the dimension of the perceptual space. Yes?
So I would have thought the difficulty with applying this kind of triggered covariance method here would really be in figuring out how to represent the percept or whatever it is, how to represent in terms of S in vectors in the first place.
So point here is that this, again, so the idea is that S lives in the physical space that you decided to use, and the differences are all small. So you can actually choose as your coordinates the concentrations of all the molecules that you're fiddling up and down, and then you get what you get. Now, it might be that if you could do something more clever. So for example, if you did this in color vision, the analog would be to choose the intensities of 100 different wavelengths. Okay? Now obviously, if you knew to choose the things that correspond to the Cohen absorption spectra, you'd be much better off. But you could, by this technique, discover that things were three-dimensional. Right? Yes.
So it sounds like you could do something, you could make an assumption that the natural world is somehow representative of the dimensionality of our odor space,
mm-hmm.
and take, you know, 1,000 odors that you find in the natural world.
So this theorem theorem hinges on Gaussianity. It's actually important that you choose from a Gaussian distribution. Now you're asking, can I do?
So how do you know?
Well, you have to make them. So you have to make them, right? So you have to actually have, you know, you have to mix odors with concentrations which have some average value, and from trial to trial they fluctuate by some Gaussian random number that you insert, right?
You can totally do this.
You can do this experiment. The problem is whether with a reasonable amount of data you'll get clean results. And so let me just finish by saying something about that. So what should happen is if you look at the eigenvalues of the change in the covariance matrix. So this is the triggered. So there's the triggered covariance versus the simulus covariance. If you look at the eigenvalues and you just put them in order, and the ordering of things is usually called rank, but rank means something else here. So let's just put them as dimensions. What you should see is some crap, and then the dimensions that stand out. That would be the hope, okay, if all went well. Now, the good news is that this part is due entirely to your finite sampling noise, and we understand that because that's the question of the errors in estimating a covariance matrix by drawing samples is a well-studied mathematical problem. This is the Marchenko-Pasteur distribution, you can be a little cheaper than that if you assume that you have a reasonably large number of samples. What you could say is that, well, I compute the covariance matrix under these conditions, and I compute it under these conditions, and if there wasn't really anything different about these except the fact that there was a finite number of samples, the difference between these would be a D by D random matrix. It's a special one because you got it out of the samples, but that specialness isn't terribly important as long as the number of samples is large. The typical matrix element would be of order 1 over square root of the number of samples, right? Because it's a statistical error. So I have a D by D, I have a dimensionality D matrix whose elements are of order 1 over square root of n. And so this width here will be the square root of the dimensionality of the stimulus space divided by the number of samples. Okay? So that's fantastic news because it says that if I want to explore a space that's twice the dimensionality, not the perceptual space, but the stimulus space, because I don't know how big I need to make the space, so I have to keep trying to make the stimulus space bigger, I only pay linearly. That's fantastic because most of these other things seem to be much worse than that. Okay, your intuition is that if I want to explore a space of dimensionality D, I need exponentially many points. That's not true. The bad news, which I must say it took me a little time and some disappointment to appreciate, is that these are eigenvalues of the covariance matrix. So the scaling that I wrote down is correct, but what about their physical dimension, right? It's the covariance of the stimulus. And so this scales as sigma squared, which is the variance of the individual components that you're moving on. If you go through the algebra here, you'll notice that you have two factors of the covariance of the stimulus, and the thing in between is a derivative with respect to the stimuli. So this is a number whose scale is fixed by the box that you're trying to study. Now, the box that you're trying to study might adapt to the distribution, and so that's interesting, but even so, the point is that the individual matrix elements do not obviously have to scale with the number of dimensions that you're in. So this is a number. Whereas these things go like sigma to the fourth. So naively, unless you get saved in some way, this goes like sigma to the fourth. Right? So now the problem is that if I'm making comparisons. Suppose I make comparisons in a five-dimensional space. Well, in order to get reasonable measurements, right, I want, again, I'm sensitive to derivatives of this function. So I don't want to be out here. Right? I don't want to compare things that are too easy to tell apart. I want to be in here. But in here, that means that things have a distance of order one. But if I'm in five dimensions, then that means that the variance along one coordinate has to be one-fifth. Right? Because you get contributions from every dimension. So it appears that this will go like 1 over the dimensionality of the perceptual space squared, and this will go like 1 over the dimensionality of the perceptual space. And that suggests that in order to get a good measurement, you need a number of samples which scales like that, which is good news for exploring very high-dimensional stimulus spaces, but bad news for exploring high-dimensional perceptual spaces. Now, what I haven't thought through is whether you might be saved by adaptation. So if you spend all your time trying to make decisions in this region, it's possible that the scale over which you make your decisions becomes tuned to that. And if I start doing this, then you adapt to that as well. And then in that case, you can get out of this. And I haven't figured that out yet. I mean, that, you see that effect in neurons. Presumably, you see some of it perceptually. Whether that actually solves this problem, I don't know. But the result is that, you know, if you deliver stimuli in a 20-dimensional space and you're trying to distinguish that there are really only 10, then this tells you that you need many more than 2,000, which is not so bad. There seem to be some prefactors because playing, I found that really things only got nice and crisp when you were at a few hundred thousand. But that's a lot better than the millions that you need. It's an order of magnitude better. So, okay. So let me try to summarize.
So the algebra, I kind of call it. You draw a picture of this. It's, you start with a Gaussian, and you get a skinnier Gaussian, right? And you do this is basically yesterday covariance analysis. Can you point to that and say where?
So the conditional distribution does not have to be Gaussian.
Right. Right.
So what it does is, right, the way to think about it is, right, the conditional distribution would be the probability of saying yes multiplied by the prior distribution. So so I have a Gaussian, and then the...
I'm just wondering if it's an easy picture. That it's not.
Well, so look, along one dimension it's easy, right? It's this turns into...
Yeah.
That, something like that, right? Because you're asking same or different, so the sign doesn't matter. And so now imagine that this happens in a space of more dimensions. So let's say we're in two dimensions, and you start with something like this. And let's see, what's going to happen? Along one dimension, you have this effect, and along the other dimension, you don't. So that would say, I don't know, the contours become something like this, right? You kind of dig this little, at the one sigma level, you sort of dig out this thing, right? Because you have, again, relatively high probability. Actually, it becomes non-monotonic, right? So you get a little piece of the contour out here. I'm not sure exactly how to draw it. So you're getting this, you know, the Gaussian's getting its center dug out. But the point is that's not happening along all the dimensions, it's only happening along some of them. I should give you a clearer picture.
It's very elegant. It's only local dimensionality.
Exactly. Okay, so let me...
In a way, it's a little bit unfair to compare it with, say, MDS, because MDS evaluates the entire manifold, right?
So, let me try to summarize Fine. Okay. So look, again, this is my groping toward trying to find a formulation of this question that at least comes with a way of answering it experimentally. I think that formulating the question globally is hard. I think formulating it locally invites several methods that you could try using, some of which will work better than others, and maybe there's one we haven't thought of here. I think that MDS in principle is a global method, but I was arguing that even in formulating the question, we should try to stay local, so that for reasons that have nothing to do with the limitations of MDS, but rather with the limitations of my conception of what a perceptual space means. I'm pretty sure I understand what's happening if I look locally. I have a harder time with things that are very far apart. It is not obvious, by the way, that this is a unique, it is obvious that this is not a unique definition. And let me remind you that there are distinctions, for instance, between perception and action. And so, for example, it might be that if I do something like what you guys did, and I ask somebody for a description of a single odor, that's just very different. That's a very different problem than being asked to discriminate two nearby odors. So for instance, there are visual illusions to which your visually driven motor outputs are not susceptible. So you see things as, if I ask you to describe them, you will tell me all sorts of funny things about them. If I ask you to reach for them, you will reach correctly. Okay. So this is a murky area, and exactly where the boundaries are isn't clear. But remember that even in a single system, right, relatively well understood, you have the problem that different ways of probing people's internal representation, or more precisely, asking people to use their internal representation to do different things can produce very different answers. So it's not clear that there's some unique thing standing behind this vague question about dimensionality. So the idea was, my idea was, if I think locally I know what to do, that excludes a whole bunch of things. In particular, right, it almost excludes the how many different things can you discriminate question, because that's a global question and not a local question. Although I think that if the answer to the dimensionality question is that the dimensionality is high, then you almost necessarily have the answer that the number of things you can discriminate is very large, although it may not be as large as you think, right? But it's I think the qualitative answer to the number of distinguishable things really hinges on dimensionality. Even if you take a modest number and raise it to a very large power, you get a big answer, right? So in some sense, the question of the dimensionality of odor perception versus the dimensionality nobody thinks that the question of the dimensionality of odor perception versus color perception is about the signal-to-noise ratio in the individual receptors. That is to say, the number that you raise to the power, right? It's the question is about the power, right? Is it true that because I have hundreds of receptors instead of three, I get a much bigger number? Okay. So then, if you proceed locally, then there are various things you can try doing. The thing that I think is interesting about correlation-based methods, in this sense, or triggered methods, is that they allow, in a sense, sort of every perceptual judgment contributes one data point, right? And so in that sense, they seem like an efficient use of your experimental time. Now, there's a lot of details you have to get right to convince yourself that you don't end up paying that factor back somewhere else. But that's the attractiveness. The other thing that I think is interesting about it is that even though I don't, as I might in MDS, in some sense, you're trying to actually recover the vectors that constitute the representation, and you can look at them and look at their singular value decomposition, and that tells you something about their dimensionality. Here, you're not trying to recover the internal vectors, but you still have a spectrum that you can look at with if the notion of restricted dimensionality is correct, you have a big gap. And that's the kind of thing that I find, if I see this with four X's up here and a bunch of stuff down here, I'd be inclined to believe the claim that the thing was four-dimensional, right? In a way that, seeing something here, you might not be sure. Again, here, you would be sure. So I like things that have that visual feel. And it seems like it's an efficient use of the experimental time. I wouldn't know how to prove that it was the most efficient use. I'm not even sure that's well defined. And of course, it does. All of these things depend on details that I certainly don't have control over. But if you think that the dimensionality is 5, then I think you should just go to work on collecting data and try to push them through several of these things and see what you can get. If you think the dimensionality is 10, then you want to do a lot more calculating to convince yourself you'll be able to see anything. And if the dimensionality is 100, you're certainly not going to measure 100. Do you want to do this in a fly where the number of receptors is small? I don't know. Okay, how you map this onto real experiments, I'm not all sure about. So I'm going to stop because I've told you, as one colleague said about another, more than I know already. So stop. Yeah.
So I have some of my view on this, but
I'm shocked.
I would like to hear your opinion. So you're talking to the group of people who this is a fascinating subject and we're really interested. But on a more general care, why do we care?
So
why do we care about dimensionality? What actually decided it's happened to be small in
right, that's right. So we're misled by the example of color.
That's right.
I don't know. Look, I think so. There's an even older literature than multidimensional scaling and talking about the dimensionality of. So look, at some level, trying to give a mathematical description of the way in which our perceptions are represented is somehow very appealing. When people started recording from neurons, somehow that fell out of favor, strangely, because the representation is obviously what all the neurons are doing, and that's that. Although, as there's a lot of concern about, whether the activity of neurons is low dimensional or high dimensional, right? And anyhow. When you run one fingertip over a surface, right, you're deploying roughly 100 receptors. Even if each of them can only signal on or off, that's 2 to the 100 possible patterns, which is 10 to the 30th, which is not only more things than you're going to experience in your lifetime, it's more than all of the human beings who've ever lived on Earth experienced across all of their lifetimes. And so you might think that this tells you a priori that it's completely absurd. But that's not true, actually. And the reason is that the observation that, how many different things you can experience during your lifetime, that's only useful if you have them all in a book to start with. Right? So the statement that I have a larger information, that the number of stimuli I can distinguish with my fingertip is larger than the number of stimuli I will experience in my lifetime, you might say, that must mean that, you could compress things down to a list of, just tell me which of the billion stimuli it is that I'm going to experience in my lifetime. Well, yeah, but that requires that you have a book in which all the stimuli you're going to experience in your lifetime are listed, right? And then you can just say, it's stimulus number 42, and you're done. Right? but that's not how it works, right? So it's the same reason that you are actually willing, you know, why on earth did anybody get rid of their 1 megapixel camera to get a 5 megapixel camera? Right. Well, so you might be skeptical about this one, but or a 10 megapixel camera. It's not because you expect that you're going to see more than 10, you know, than 8 to the 1 million pictures in your lifetime, right? That's the wrong comparison. So the issue of the capacity of your sensory system is an interesting one, and its relationship to what you encounter in the world and so on. I think these are interesting questions, and the dimensionality is one way of getting at that. In most of our sensory systems, right, color vision is extremely misleading because most of our sensory systems are automatically high-dimensional, right? When you look at something, your fovea has order 10,000 photoreceptors in it. Half of them are green and half of them are red, okay? But that doesn't mean your perception is two-dimensional. You put 10,000 channels on one small part of the visual world. And then the question is, In what space are we actually making the comparisons of those data? And how big is that? Is it a really high-dimensional space? And you know, I don't care whether it's 10,000-dimensional or 5,000-dimensional. If it were really true that there were 37 prototypical patterns I was looking for, I'd like to know that, right?
So basically, the next step about this question, if we come after all this, you know, we do all this experiment and find the dimensionality is there's two kind of questions. Either dimensionality is higher than 10 and we get it, or dimensionality is, I don't know, 7. Whatever it is.
Plus or minus 2? Yeah.
Yeah, 7. Oh. So basically, what did we learn from, what the next step? We do
so look,
all this stuff.
In the case, so again, let's take the color vision case that where we think we understand something. So in color vision, we have this enormous dimensionality reduction from the space of possible lights, right,
yeah,
to three numbers. And it is a reasonable, although this is not what most people spend their time doing, right, the reason that's been so important as a practical matter, right, is that then, you know, you know how to make monitors, you know how to, right. But conceptually, there's a really interesting question as to why nature has chosen to use this very low-dimensional description of what might, in principle, have been a much more complicated world. So in the case of olfaction, at least for mammals, we know that the number of receptors is rather large. And so but it's still vastly smaller than the set of possible molecules. So one idea is you should try and understand why, given the enormous space of possible molecules, you've chosen to make so few receptors. Okay, that's a really interesting question. And why these and not something else? Is there something you can understand that, you know, there are people in the room who've thought about this? But then, if it turns out that your perceptual comparisons are made in a yet lower dimensional space, then you could ask, well, you know, what's up with that, right? I mean, that would be the analog of taking, you know, the tens of thousands of receptors in my fovea and somehow only looking for a very limited number of patterns or using only a very limited number of templates. And if that were true, everybody would agree that it was important to understand why we'd chosen those templates, right?
I mean, vision, we say the story we tell ourselves is that the edges, corners, and what have you that make up images, in the end, you use very low dimension space of features because you can construct complex objects from them.
Yeah, but those are, right, that's since you can find them at any place.
Right. Then you have
that's still of order the same number,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
So, but then the fact that they're objects, right, is the statement that conjunctions of those things at
translation.
Right. You could take out translation variants and conjunctions of these things.
And then as you go centrally.
Right. You lower the dimensionality, but we don't know. But sort of one view is that for objects, what you do is you build the list of all the things you've seen, right? Because it really isn't that big. And so making the look, making, you know, there is a theory which is almost the lookup table, right? With a little bit of interpolation. It's basically lookup table plus interpolation. And so, but that isn't, that still leaves you, but then in that case, I think the dimensionality in which you make the comparison somehow of order the number of different objects, right? Because you sort of somehow have some sort of, you know, the vector that you compute is the something like the probability that you're looking at any one of those templates or something. And that's still actually quite high. It's perhaps not as high as you started with, but still large.
But you said
it was an interesting question to try and think about that.
But you sort of switch to objects and we started color. Is there any equivalent for that in vision people?
Like, is there any what?
Is there any equivalent of an object lookup table for the color? Because that was the analogy that we started with.
Right. So the point is that if your receptors, if from the physical space to your receptors, the collapse is not so large, right? So you're left with many thousands of dimensions, or tens of thousands of dimensions. Then, when you try to find something like objects, is where you do the projection. Whereas with color, you know, since you drop down to three, you kind of don't need to do anymore, right?
Yeah. I guess my point of thing is that the analogy, in some sense, is not clear. That once we know the thousand, is that where we don't need to learn anymore in the olfactory system, or is it more analogous to the creating objects again with these receptors?
Right. So So it might be that there are good reasons to collapse from the order, you know, from the many hundreds or thousand receptor dimensions to something less. There might not. I have no idea. So it would seem to me that if it turned out that there was a substantial collapse there, that would be interesting. And it would be interesting to know whether, you know, is that something we inherit, or is it something we learn, or is it, right? That whole set of issues, it seems to me, you know, do all animals do that?
Could that
seems to be answering the question.
So I think that would be interesting. If we have 400 receptors and the dimensionality of the space in which we make comparisons is 50, is that interesting? Probably not. First of all, I can't think of an experiment that would convincingly demonstrate that was true. But even if I told you it was true, 400 versus 50.
It still means you treat a lot of stimuli as that are physically different, even though different in terms of receptor activation, as identical.
Right, but.
Which I think is then interesting.
I mean,
why doesn't organism treat those as subspace as just one?
Actually, can we distinguish treating them identically and treating them along the same number of dimensions? What I'm trying to point out is there may be different dimensions, but you can put them in different places along the perceptual space, and then still be different. So we have to be careful.
Right.
There's always, you know, trade-offs. For example, you know,
we just finished that. So it's possible that the patterns of activation of the, let's say, 400 dimensions that occur in nature are themselves lower dimensions.
Yeah.
So we have learned that, and that our default is to make comparisons in that lower dimensional space, which would then, and if that were actually true, and you could work out all the steps, it seems to me that would be a rather profound bit of understanding. It would be analogous to explaining why it is that we choose the three photoreceptors that we do, except on a much bigger scale, and maybe even more interesting because the collapse is done in our brains and not by synthesizing pigment molecules. By the way, you shouldn't minimize the difficulty of synthesizing pigment molecules, but let's say it's a problem that would inform our thinking about neuroscience as opposed to our thinking about chemistry. You know, right? Which, you know, take your pick. Right? I mean, it's a different kind of problem. Yeah.
This is a bit more for practical. If you were to do these experiments, would you like to prefer others that are really constraining the number of other receptors that they strongly activate, or would you prefer to have these other reserves?
I think, look, I think that, so first of all, my understanding is that in mammals, finding if I really knew how to adjust the activation of the different receptors, I think I'd like to do that. I'm skeptical about whether we know how to do that. Except optically, of course. But then it's hard to do quantitatively, I guess. I think that for this purpose, you'd like to...
Why
would I want to do that?
Why do you want to do it? What's difficult?
Well, so what's difficult is to know. Remember that you're not at least the things I've talked about, and maybe there's another strategy, right? So within the things I've talked about, you want to have stimuli that are near to each other.
Yeah.
So that means that they have to surround a perceivable stimulus, which is presumably reasonably far away from zero concentrations of things, right? That means that all of the components of your mixture are going to be present at a reasonable concentration, and therefore the problem of excluding, if you really wanted to believe that your dimensions corresponded to activation of the receptors, you have to exclude weak activation of a large number of alternative receptors. And I don't know that we know how to do that. If we were working at very low concentrations, you could say, I don't know, I tried this against all the receptors and this is the only one that turned on. But if all the molecules are up at some reasonable concentration, then it's possible that although one of the receptors is dominant, a very large number of them are a little bit active, and that's exactly the kind of situation where talking about dimensionality gets tricky, right?
So, yes. So, in this idea, is the dimensionality, I don't know, is there a way to prove that these dimensions that you are not finding are kind of hugging the dimensions of the receptor space, or are versus the idea that they are just combinations of receptors? I mean, it's a different question.
I think, look, how many receptors are there in a fly? I thought in a larval fly it's 25, right? And you could certainly genetically engineer one that was 12, right? I mean, yeah, we know you could do one, right?
Yeah,
but one is maybe a little too much, right, for this discussion. Although, I don't know. Yeah. My understanding is that the one is already problematic. We don't understand that one. So you could think about engineering, and you have to worry about, okay, but let's say, let me do better. Suppose I found an organism in which had six different kinds of receptors. Now clearly I can produce mixtures of a dozen chemicals and control them. That experiment you can do. So it would be fascinating to deliver mixtures of a dozen chemicals and discover that their perception of odor was six-dimensional by some argument like this and say, look, see, it works, right? This one I can do, right? I'm not sure, I don't know what happens when there's 400 receptors, they have six, okay, really works, okay? That's what it means. And I think that would be, I don't know, given the amount of trouble that this problem seems to be causing people, I would think that actually, if you could do that one, that would be pretty cool.
I mean, interestingly, you have six receptors and you find two.
Well, so let's think about the alternatives. There's six receptors that you discover that it's two-dimensional. Oh, that's interesting. So it does the collapse that, okay. You have six receptors and you give 12 odors and you discover that it's 12-dimensional. And the reason, of course, is that you have time, and you're assuming that you're delivering snapshots, but maybe not, right? After all, you know, in this particular creature, in which the air is delivered in a moderately turbulent way with the funny geometry of its antennae, blah, blah, blah.
It has 900 receptors. And how many neurons?
Two,
I don't know,
something.
Two or four.
Sense
neurons.
So maybe the answer is we should do this with C. elegans.
How will you tell C. elegans to tell you what's different or same?
Well,
I'm sure there's a way to figure out.
Well, I think it's a, I don't know, maybe this is interesting, right? I don't know that we, right, so we, do we understand how they deploy it?
I mean, it's what people work in sales, right? Everything in sales against is almost all this sort of innate, like, you know, they just look for it, go away or go, it's not that you're teaching it.
No, 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 there is learning.
Like what?
What?
What it, can you learn?
That was another topic I was thinking. But, you know, for example, they learn the size of the probability distribution or which food is.
But there's a very long statistical thing. You're talking about the foraging versus the.
No, I mean, but they learn on the order of 30 minutes. Is that long?
But you have to learn, teach them every. I don't know. You have to make them do your.
But it's also true.
Quickly, right?
No, but it's also true that, you know, they're continuously behaving, right? So they do something of order once per second.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can take it running.
And so if I could do some sort of correlation style analysis, I'm getting samples every few seconds. Let's not assume that every second is independent of every other second. So I don't know if I can watch them, if I can, and I can make them genetically identical. So maybe averaging over worms isn't such a terrible thing to do. So I don't know. Maybe that's a reasonable experiment. Yes.
So slightly different aspect of the discussion. So it's kind of the picture that you draw. We can think about some experiments for the actual real physical space with presenting stimulus and presenting, you know, mixture of orderlies varying the concentration, blah blah blah. Now, how this we can map on the stimulation of individual receptors? We have now a genetic approach. We can simulate more or less, not in mice, this, you know, a few thousand mammals, we can simulate 200 mammals individually. So, but that's a different space. Now,
look, if you want to, you can have the stimulus be the intensity of 200 spots of light.
Right, but
and you can do the same. You can ask the same set of questions.
Exactly, but what we learn from that, we have, let's say, we can look at it as some kind of model organism at 200, you know, glomerular, we can simulate individual intensity of the light or something like that, some binary, whatever, we can do some of this stuff. How that actually, what do we learn from that about the problem that we discussed? Is it, you know, fair mapping from stimulus? Now we're talking, you know, we're skipping one step, stimulus to receptors. We're stimulating more or less weak because it's quite artificial.
Yeah.
So,
but because the receptors are broadly tuned, it would seem to me that it's a fair thing to do. Right? I mean,
that's my question. Is it a fair thing to do? Because any normal stimuli in the world stimulates some sets of stimuli.
So the worry, well, I don't know. I mean, I think that our ability to answer questions of this flavor is more. I mean, so let's not even assume we have exactly the right formulation, right? So something like this is going to be related. To your ability to have a very large number of trials in which the stimuli along the raw physical dimensions are very well defined. Okay?
Yep.
Now, if you can make great progress by moving to optical stimulation of the glomeruli, then it seems to me that that would be an interesting thing to do, and then you could ask later, you know, you won't be able to ask how that relates to the distribution of odors that are actually in nature, but for example, if you discovered that despite stimulating, so for instance, it's clear that sampling, controlling 100 dimensions when I'm doing optical stimulation is feasible, whereas controlling 100 dimensions when I'm actually delivering odors, right, good luck.
But
So in that sense, there's a direction in which you can go vastly further by doing this less direct thing. And so that's interesting. I mean, you have to sit down with the detail. Right. If all you get is some sort of blah mess out of the data. So, for instance, if what you give up is the number of trials, I'm just making something up, right? And so, yes, you can probe a much higher dimensional space, but because of the constraints of actually, you know, holding him fixed and doing all this stuff, the amount of time you actually get to spend doing it is much smaller. And so the result is you get much poorer statistics. Well, actually going to higher dimensions with poorer statistics is not what you want to do, right? And the fact that you can address things that are genetically identified is by itself of no interest, right? At least for these kinds of questions. So I don't know. I mean, look, you could say the question I really care about is if I have N neurons feeding into some part of my brain, am I really capable of doing things that live in N dimensions? That's what I really care about, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, when I use more neurons, am I really increasing my capacity in ways that I think about? Or maybe I'm in a region of the brain where, yeah, I've got more neurons going in, but the set of things I can compute is so limited that the only thing I can use the more neurons for is to get greater accuracy about a small number of things. And that, both of those, you know, you can imagine situations in which both of those are the things you want to do, and you'd like to be able to tell them apart. And then exactly what those neurons are connected to in the outside world, well, I mean, presumably the answer to this question will make more or less
Right,
and even with C. elegans, by the way, it might be more interesting to optically stimulate some number of its receptor neurons.
It's only two or three.
Well, I think it's much more peculiar, right? One neuron expresses.
Right, but I might like to try controlling the activity of the neurons rather than wafting things over them.
It's actually being done by people for other.
Yes.
I think I was thinking in spirit of there might be some people who want to go. I mean, I would certainly stay here and talk more, but I'm just wondering if we could formally end it maybe with one last question and then we'll keep bugging Bill afterwards.
I have a small technical question. It seems to me it's dp to the minus 2.
Did I do that wrong? That can't be. These things get smaller. No, it's possible that I got it wrong, but it can't be that it goes the other way.
That would be a good news, though. It's easier to estimate.
So the problem is that if the dimensionality of the space is the dimensionality of perceptual space is larger, then you need the variance along each dimension to be smaller, so that the typical distance stays order one. And that means that these points come down relative to those. So it gets harder in higher dimensions. Now, did I get the, I think what the equations on the board say.
Should be order one.
Is this must be larger. Sorry, other way. That, right? So 1 over dp squared, this height, has to be much larger than this width.
All right.
Okay. Now we're okay, I think. Yeah.
Cool.
All right.
Thanks,
sure.
Okay.